bird note. A rainy day can spoil the best laid plans to enjoy the outdoors, and watching bird videos online isn't nearly as fun as exploring your surroundings while birding. But the video game Alba, a wildlife adventure, lets you have adventures in a stunning virtual landscape while curled up at home with a cup of hot cocoa. The game puts you in the shoes of a birdwatcher and conservationist on a Mediterranean island. As you traverse the animated ecosystem, listen for the calls of over 50 birds, like the Eurasian sparrowhawk, or the northern shoveler, which only appears after your character has cleaned up a local nature reserve. Some birds can only be found in certain regions of the game. House sparrows make themselves at home in the town, while great cormorants congregate on big rocks near the beach. Alba can be a great way to learn more about birds, or just a nice excuse to birdwatch without leaving the couch. The game is available on phones, consoles, or your computer. Learn more at birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM SFU Burnaby. New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. We at New Dimensions thank you for your support. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest, as we explore new dimensions.
Our guest today says nothing is harder to do than nothing. In a world where our value is determined by our productivity, many of us find our every last minute captured, optimized, or appropriated as a financial resource by the technologies we use daily. She goes on to say, the convenience of limitless connectivity has neatly paved over the nuances of in-person conversation, cutting away so much information and context in the process. In an endless cycle where communication is stunted and time is money, there are few moments to step away and fewer ways to find each other. Today, we'll be exploring the increasingly materialistic and pragmatic orientation of our age and how to reroute and deepen our attention and explore what is hijacking the ageless need for community, solitude, and conviviality with our guest, Jenny O'Dell. Jenny O'Dell is a multidisciplinary artist and writer based in Oakland, California, who teaches at Stanford University. She has been an artist in residence at such places as the San Francisco Dump, Facebook, the Internet Archive, and San Francisco Planning Department, and has exhibited her art all over the world. She is the author of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Join us for the next hour as we explore what is the attention economy and how is it co-opting our lives with our guest, Ginny O'Dell. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Ginny, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to be with you. I would like to start off, first of all, if you could describe, in 2016, you started hanging out in the Rose Garden in Oakland, California, and that was as a respite from all that was going on in the news, I believe. Can you describe why you were hanging out there?
Sure. And that's kind of where this whole book came out of, was this moment. I will say it wasn't totally intentional. I think I found that I was going to this Rose Garden almost out of an instinct. It's also very close to my apartment. And I had been going there somewhat regularly, but at this point in time, I was going there a lot, like every spare moment, and not doing anything, not even reading, not writing, just kind of like sitting and I think trying to process. You know, this was not just after the election, but also after the ghost ship fire in Oakland. So, you know, friends of mine had passed away, and that event in itself, the way it was being covered in the media, was really problematic, I think.
And for those who don't know about that fire, just a little overview.
Yeah, so it was a warehouse fire that happened in Oakland. There was an event going on, so I think 36 people died. And a lot of them were artists. A lot of them were, you know, just very community-minded people. So it was a loss that was really heavily felt, I think, by the whole city. And certainly many people I knew were in a state of shock, especially because it happened, I think, about a month after the election. So, you know, it was just, there was like this kind of pall hanging over me and a lot of people that I knew. And my reaction was to go and sit in this Rose Garden, not without a feeling of guilt. You know, like I should be engaging or I should be doing something, but I just simply found that I couldn't.
And what I noticed, you were very, very wisely, for me, gave us an indication that this book, even though the title of it, How to Do Nothing, might indicate, oh, this is a self-help book, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's such a great provocative title. And what you introduced to us in the very beginning is this is going to be more like walking in that rose garden, which doesn't have straight pathways, but, you know, meanders and wanders around and curves around. And that's kind of, I think you use the word, this will be essaying forth, which I loved.
Yeah, like the original, or, you know, one of the meanings of the word essay is to go, you know, trace a path, right? Like you end somewhere different than where you began, maybe even somewhere where you didn't know you would end up. So it is, I mean, for me, it was an honest questioning and investigation that, as I say in the book, there were many things I encountered in researching and writing that I didn't expect, even myself, and that I myself was changed through the process of writing, so I don't end up in the same place either. And some of that also is a formal way of resisting being turned into a soundbite. So much of the problem that I am trying to identify in this book is, you know, has to do with knee-jerk reaction, which the attention economy runs on, and this inability to see context and nuance, like this ability that's being eroded by being bombarded with the most reduced version of information all day. And so I think I shaped the book in a way that where I tried to make it so that you can't do that with it.
right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you just took our hand and we walked side by side and you took us to surprising places, I must say. It was really fun. And I mean, not a quick read in that way. You know, you don't just flip through it, but you meander slowly and contemplate. It was wonderful. One of the things that you use in the very beginning of the book is you tell a story of an ancient Chinese story of the useless tree.
Yeah.
And can you describe why you use that and what that story was?
Sure. So that actually, a friend of mine told me that I should definitely look into Zhuangzi, who was, you know, the writer of that story, because I think I had been telling him about my project and that I was interested in the usefulness of uselessness. And he's like, oh, well, you definitely need to look at this body of stories. And so one of the stories was about a tree that is quite large. It's actually so large that it, in the story, is shading thousands of teams of oxen. And a carpenter comes along and sees it and kind of disdainfully is like, that tree only got to be so big because it's useless as timber, basically. It's not the right shape. And then the tree comes to him in a dream, basically mocks him and says, you know, who are you to call me useless? You don't even really know what usefulness is. And meanwhile, you're a mortal man about to die. It's just like, a lot of the stories, you know, a lot of Zhuangzi stories are really funny because they turn on this kind of irony of like, the joke of that story is that our version of usefulness is so narrow that we can't see very obvious, you know, other forms of usefulness, like the fact that it's shading all of these animals, or the fact that it's been useful for the tree itself. It's still alive. It's still there because it couldn't be so easily appropriated. And I was just really taken with that story because I realized we had a real life version of that in Oakland, which is a tree, an old growth redwood tree, which I did not know about, called Old Survivor. And it's really like a real life version. It was not cut down in the 1800s because it was considered small by old growth redwood standards. And I think it's also a bit of an odd shape and it's hard to get to. It's kind of out on a rocky outcrop. And yeah, there you go, right? It's like it wasn't cut down because it wasn't the right, it didn't lend itself to the lumber industry, you know? And so in its uselessness, it was useful.
So here is this old tree, more than 500 years old, that exists there in the hills of Oakland somehow, and really a reminder of the context from which we came, where the whole hillside was full of redwoods at one time, much bigger than that one even.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And, you know, that's not that long ago. You know, I'm someone, I grew up in California. I spend a lot of time up north. I seek out old growth redwood forests, and now there are these, you know, amazing state parks. And it's like, it's crazy to think that we could have had one right here, right? Something I mentioned at the end of the book is a map by Liam O'Donohue and T.L. Simon. So Liam is the host of East Bay Yesterday, which is a history podcast specific to Oakland, and T.L. Simons is an illustrator, and they made a map of all of the plants and animals that have gone extinct in Oakland. Or not necessarily specific species, but like old growth redwoods, like when those mostly disappeared, as well as things like the Key System, which was a mass transportation system that we had, the Ohlone Shell Mounds, like all of these kinds of really rich history that it's sort of tragic to look at the map because you feel that it's slipping away or it has slipped away, but it's also this reminder that it's not this abstract sort of ancient thing. Like it wasn't that long ago. Yeah,
exactly. And I know that you mentioned that in the book, how you're a bird watcher. and that's, and somehow this is all connected, you know, that this has taught you something about attention in some ways. Being a bird watcher, well, how does that go with attention?
I think one of the things I was really trying to explore, and I still am, honestly, is qualities of attention, different qualities of attention, and also how they affect your sense of time. So in the attention economy, for example, advertising. Advertising online is often, you know, the effectiveness is measured in amount of time you spend on a website or number of clicks, right? It assumes that all attention is the same. It's all rather shallow. So if someone's looking at it longer rather than shorter, then that's better, right? It doesn't really make any room for the possibility of different kinds of attention, like deeper, more critical attention. Like, what if I'm looking at an ad critically? They can't measure that, right? You know, definitely the attention economy runs on and encourages and produces a form of attention that's very shallow and reactive and not seeking context. But, you know, for me, that's all the more reason to make an effort to practice or develop forms of attention that are different from that, that maybe proceed at a slower pace or a different scale, from a different angle. And these are all things that I have thought about for a long time as an artist and as someone who looks at art. A lot of the examples in the book that I give of art pieces that I appreciate are ones that can help you do that. They're almost like an attention prosthetic or something that lets you pay this different kind of attention that ends up being a really important defense when you are then faced with the attention economy.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Jenny Odell, and she's the author of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, jennyodell.com, or you can also go to the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Jenny Odell. She's the author of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Jenny, as we're talking about attention and the kind of attention, I'm thinking of something that you wrote and you experienced when you went to a concert. Mm-hmm. It may have been with John Cage or mm-hmm. some, was it with John Cage in San Francisco? And help us understand how you were affected by that concert and what was the content of that concert.
Sure. Yeah, so I had been familiar with John Cage. You know, I went to art school for grad school. And I think I had seen documentation of some of his pieces, but I think it's important that I had never seen one live. And it's also important that the way he tends to score his pieces, it's different every time it's performed. So I was at the symphony, San Francisco Symphony, which, as a classical music nerd, you know, I know that there is sort of a protocol to that. Like, you are quiet as an audience member. The orchestra wears all black. There's like the part where they're tuning, and you know, this kind of decorum to that space. And in this particular piece, this entire stage setup was different. There were things like, you know, a place for a player to shuffle cards into a microphone. There was a lot of sort of chance operation. The liner notes said this piece will last anywhere between like 15 and 30 minutes, depending on what happens, which is like not something you would normally see in liner notes. There were vocalists, but the vocalizations they were making were very strange. And I noticed that, you know, people were sort of, as I'm sure is common at a lot of John Cage performances, kind of shifting around in their seats almost like uncomfortably because it's sort of funny or it's just like very out of the ordinary. And at some point, Michael Tilson Thomas used a blender to make milkshake, and because the blender is in the score, and people at that point, like people just like couldn't hold it in anymore and started laughing. And it just totally broke through this film of like assumptions about like how you were supposed to act in that space and what you're hearing. But more than that, because these sounds were so kind of pedestrian, and that's, you know, John Cage's whole thing is that all sound is music. I walked out onto the street, and I've at that point had lived in San Francisco for many years, and I'm speaking literally, like I heard sounds consciously in a way that I just never had, and it changed the way that I hear sound forever, for good. Like my sense of hearing was never the same. It was almost like the equivalent maybe of getting a hearing aid or something, right? And it's And I, as I say in the book, it's not that I was necessarily hard of hearing. Like, presumably these sounds were making their way into my ears and my brain, but they were not making it to the level of consciousness. I wasn't paying attention to them. And this is kind of what I mean by art that, that helps you, because this piece was necessary to draw my attention to sound once. I only needed it once, and then it, you know, that was true of the way that I hear, you know, subsequently after that.
So it really expanded your ability to hear. I mean, you were siloed before that in some ways in your hearing. You didn't, you'd walk down the street and you would just tone out all of those street noises, but now they're coming into your being after that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then that takes me to the role of the artist in, and writers, artists, musicians in our culture, you being one, the art installation that I mentioned, that you were artist in residence at the San Francisco Dump. We've got to describe to our listeners what that was like and what came out of that.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite. No, that was probably my favorite artist residency I've ever done. So it was at Recology SF, which is kind of towards South San Francisco a little bit. I also want to just say that they have amazing art exhibitions three times a year, because there's three rounds of residence every year, and I highly recommend, like, those are some of the best art exhibitions I've ever been to. So I did this in 2015, and I basically had 3 months where I had a studio on the site, and then I had access to the public disposal area, which is not the trash that you're throwing out in trash bags. It's more kind of U-Hauls, decluttering, debris, things going out of business. And my project, which is unlike what I think normally or maybe more commonly happens there, which is that you use the trash as material. I didn't use it as material and I didn't make anything. I simply researched 200 objects, almost to a degree of absurdity. Like, you know, what is the address of the factory where this was made? Why was this made? What is it made out of? What does that process look like? Is there a commercial for this thing on YouTube? Like, what do people think about this thing? You know, just on and on and on. You know, I kind of drove myself crazy at a certain point, but that's just how I work.
So are you saying, like, if you see the exhibit, it's like going through a museum of 200 pieces, each one in its own room, so to speak, with all of its history and makeup and lots of information on each one. I mean, it would take hours and hours and days to go through it, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I was really pleased that some people who came to the first night of the exhibition came back the next day because they wanted to look at the rest of the objects. And I should describe the way that it looked was basically that I had white shelves and I had these objects on them, and then I had these very bureaucratic looking tags because my project was called the Bureau of Suspended Objects. I'm the Bureau. It's a one-person Bureau. And they had QR codes on them that you could scan with your phone, and so you could see, you know, like Google Street View of the factory, watch the commercial, you know. And yeah, I did see people kind of going, making their way down, scanning every single one. And it has a kind of similar effect, or I hoped it had a similar effect to the cage piece, which is that after a certain amount of time, I wasn't selecting for interesting looking objects. I was just going in there and picking things up off the floor. And, you know, it's anything from, you know, a bank ledger from 1906 to a My Little Pony from 2011. It's really like anything. And you very quickly realize that, you know, just even, you know, my coffee mug right here is like, there is something very strange in the story of how this thing was made. Even if it's not obviously strange, it's one of those things where, like, the more you think about it, the more, you know, this something had to mold this plastic on top here. And, you know, the processes of how this was made, how it was marketed. It's probably not made the same way anymore. At a certain point, everything starts to seem like a limited edition object, even though you wouldn't think of it that way.
Right.
And it kind of destabilizes things in a way that I really love, where you can't take anything for granted anymore.
Exactly. So you mentioned some other art installations that are kind of like this insofar as it's not making a new something out of something, but two of them that you mentioned that I recall is Eleanor Coppola's Windows, her map, and also...
Oh, Scott Pollock. Yeah,
right. So mention those two, if you would.
Yeah. So, and I love those for kind of the same reason. So the Eleanor Coppola piece, and I think it's significant that she went on to become a documentary filmmaker. This is such a documentary filmmaker kind of piece to make, but she made a map of different... kind of not bodegas, but kind of store, small corner store type windows, and then had a specific day in which people were invited to go to that window and just observe it, and that whatever was happening inside that window was the art. And I think, you know, this is in the 70s. It's really important also to note that public art typically in a city is often like some kind of giant steel sculpture that looks like it landed from outer space. And it's like, here's the art, you get it or you don't, you know? And this was so, there's something so generous about this to me where it's like, no, like the art is already here. I don't need to remove it to a gallery context. It's just what is inside this window. And like the John Cage piece, it will always be different. And then the Scott Pollock piece, which was much more recent, I think it was a couple years ago, in San Diego on a cliff overlooking the ocean, he had a small group of chairs cordoned off with that kind of, I don't know what you call it, but the red sort of...
VIP. VIP room, yeah.
And the name of the piece was Applause Encouraged. So he had people sign up for this experience. He ushered them in. They sat in their seats. I think there's a little sign that says, like, kind of no photos. They watched the sunset. They clapped. And refreshments were served.
So just this collective watching the sunset together, I just loved it. I love this idea. And now going back to all of this about attention economy, and you make a case for not just dropping out and going off into the woods and just turning off all of our devices. But it's something about resisting in place as a way to resist this co-opting of our attention that's been it's big finances now these days.
Right. Yeah. It was, you know, it's hard to thread the needle on that one. And I tried to do that. Just in observing myself, where it's like, I definitely have the impulse sometimes, you know, like you have a feeling of wanting to escape, right? And I think it's just, it took me a while to tease apart, you know, like, what is it that I actually want to escape? Because I think that it's really easy for it to feel like you want to escape, for example, politics altogether, or like, you know, I'm going to throw my phone out the window, I'm never going to look at the news, I'm going to go move to a cabin in the middle of nowhere. But the more I think about it, it's like, no, that's, you know, that's not what I want. I think we also have examples of from the past where like there, that often doesn't work, you know? And so I realize that what I'm actually trying to escape is not politics, and it's not other people, and it's not like being in the world. What I'm trying to escape is the attention economy. You know, like I'm trying to escape this very specific cycle in which, you know, I am faced with a bunch of information that produces anxiety that then drives me back to that social media and, you know, attention economy. Then I get more of it, then I come back. And I'm like, oh, I'm just a water wheel for this industry, right? And everyone is a water wheel for this industry. And, like, that's what I want to walk away from. And so it's not necessarily an issue of disengaging altogether. It's disengaging from that. And actually, ironically, engaging more with, and you know, for me, people around me, you know, organizations around me, things that are out, that exist outside the attention economy, and often I think exist outside of the very like narrow, myopic sense of time and space that you encounter when you're in that state of anxiety. So for me, it's been really important to, you know, connect up with groups that are. You have been doing work for a really long time, since long before the election, right? Since long before even I started thinking about these things. And
I think of something like the people in the peace and justice movement. There are some people in there who are now in their 80s and 90s who have been at that kind of one-on-one meeting together mm-hmm. for a long, long time.
Yeah, and it works. I mean, that's what I like, you know, especially towards the end of the book, I talk about